Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's May 26th, 2007, the beginning of Memorial Day weekend. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. Our guest this afternoon is Lyndon LaRouche, a World War II veteran, the world's leading economist, a scientist, and a philosopher. This week, on his return from an extremely significant historic trip to Russia, which we will discuss on the program today, he issued a much-needed kick in the pants to Democrats with the efficient title, Democrats Wake Up. Lyndon LaRouche is presently working on a new piece called The Rules for Survival, which I presume is what he promised when he wrote in Democrats Wake Up, that he would prepare a programmatic policy statement of the type urgently needed by leading political parties which have shown themselves currently unable to grasp the actual situation which menaces our own and other nations today. So, Lynn, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Well, good to be on this today.
And we'll be joined soon by our LaRouche Youth Movement panel, which today includes Hector Rivas in Houston, Shauna Rodarte, who's currently deployed on a team which is recapturing Chicago, something I'm sure you're happy about, and Leona Fan Chang, who's part of the ongoing Gauss series project. So, Lynn, let's begin with your analysis of the present strategic situation, which you recently described in an interview on Russian television as an existential crisis of the entire world system. What's the nature of this crisis?
Well, you've got two aspects to this. You've got one of the immediate drivers is the financial crisis. Then you have a political crisis, especially in Western Europe and in North America and some other places, but there especially. And you have the overall financial crisis as well, plus real political crises in Europe and, as I said, North America. We are now at the point that, from a standpoint of forecasting, taking into account the objective financial situation, which is hopeless, at least for the present system, and taking fact that you have a political decisions are being made, which are the very worst decisions you could make for this kind of financial situation, this is a crisis. You can never predict exactly when something is going to go bust. You can locate the time frame and the situation in which something is going to happen. You don't know exactly when or exactly how. It could happen a number of ways because you have human beings who are not animals, and they do make decisions, and their decisions will tend to steer in the final analysis when and how something happens. So we're in that stage. There's only one solution now, and this is the difficult part. We could solve the problem. I know how to solve it. It's putting the system, world system, through bankruptcy reorganization. That is not an unknowable kind of challenge. The problem is getting it started. The only way we're going to do it, if it works at all, is the United States, Russia, China, and India are going to take the lead in coming to an agreement on reorganizing the world monetary financial system, going back to something like Franklin Roosevelt's design of a Bretton Woods system. We can put the world through bankruptcy reorganization, get nations to agree on fixing this and fixing that. We can get stability going. We can create large masses of state credit, especially for infrastructure and other things. We can get the economy moving again. We can work our way out of this in a period of time. And 50 years from now, if we do that, we're going to say we got out of the thing safely and successfully. It's that kind of thing. So for those who are in their 20s today, they can look forward to potentially the day which they celebrate, well, 50 years, it worked. We've done just fine. Now we go from here. But you have also the problem in Western Europe, on the continent of Europe, in England and so forth, in Central Europe, in the United States, you have ungovernable nations. Now you have to take every country in the former Comecon sector of Eastern Europe is in far worse condition physically, economically, physically, than it was the time the Soviets were controlling that part of the world. Germany is presently going into a condition of ungovernability. Italy, in a sense, is ungovernable economically but they're used to it, and they do adapt to this better than other countries do. France is going into a crisis under a new administration. The British just went through a series of elections in England, Scotland, and Wales, which are significant, which the Labour Party lost, that is, the Blair Party lost, and they're all scrambled up. The United States is essentially ungovernable. You have a president who's sitting in the White House as a dictator, under the control, however, of the vice president. You have a Democratic Party and a Republican Party to a large degree, which does not function. They are not able to face any serious issue at this point. You have an election campaign for a president going on as the primary campaigns, and none of the parties, none of the candidates now, are really worth voting for. That doesn't mean as people they're not important people, they're not capable people, but the right now the system is such that this section of our political class in the United States is now non-functional. And that's pretty much the case in Europe, especially. So you can say that you have failed states, in effect, in Western and Central Europe and in the United States right now. You have some layers in the United States which might be able to understand this and do something about it, but they're not generally the members of the Senate or the House of Representatives.
Well, then,
that doesn't mean that, yeah.
Given all the publicly available evidence that Cheney is guilty of crimes and misdemeanors, you called this week for, you demanded an immediate impeachment of Cheney. And there are indications of growing anger among the electorate against this administration. So what's it going to take to impeach Cheney, and why are leading Democrats holding back?
I don't know what it's going to take. I'm prepared to do it. But I don't know exactly how much it's going to take. Cheney's got to go, because if he doesn't go, you're having a breakdown of the White House. The guy in the White House is cracking up now. The White House as an institution is cracking up. Cheney is exerting more power now than the White House. He is involved in things, essentially controlling what the United States does. Now, how successful he's going to be, that's another question. But the problem is, we're facing not just wars in Southwest Asia and that sort of thing. We're facing police state threats here in the United States. But we're in a situation where the world is going into the greatest financial crisis in all modern history. Probably as bad or worse than what Europe experienced during the 14th century. And there's no one on the job. In Western Europe, no one's on the job. In the United States, no one's on the job. Now, what you need is they need a White House or near presidency or something tantamount to a presidency which takes the lead from the United States, since the dollar is the key to this whole world crisis, and which uses the fact that we're responsible for the dollar to go to three or four other major nations and get a pilot agreement on putting the whole system into reorganization to avoid a chain reaction bankruptcy of the world system. That has to come out of the presidency somehow or other. As long as Cheney is vice president, the presidency of the United States cannot work. We're on the verge of a crisis which can bring the whole system down into a not just a depression, but a general breakdown crisis globally. Therefore, we need a presidency in some form which can do this job. As long as Cheney is in there, the United States and most of the world does not have a chance of surviving.
Now,
because there's nobody to change the system. So you've got to get him out now, not merely because he's bad, because of what he's doing, but as long as he's in there, the United States doesn't function. And as long as the U.S. dollar is still the reserve currency of the world, that's where most of the deaths are, they're denominated in dollars. And unless we can do our job in controlling our own dollar in cooperation with other leading countries who Cheney wants to make war with, then we cannot make it as a nation. Therefore, he got to get out, because if you don't get him out, you can't do any of the things which could be done to save the world from hell.
Well, you've been talking about the problem with failed states and ungovernability. I'd like you to discuss the relationship between ungovernability and globalization. how globalization is responsible for increasing the chaos. Is this the intention of the leading promoters of globalization, or, as some say, merely an unexpected side effect?
No, not unexpected, but the motive is otherwise. We're coming into, of course, anyway, one of the great depressions in modern history. It's on now. Now, what the reaction of some people like Felix Rohatyn, for example, in the United States, is, because Felix has said so, Felix has attacked me, saying that I'm potentially something like Franklin Roosevelt. And his argument was, this was back in 2005, that we've come to a time where you have a failed presidency, i.e. the Bush presidency. And the danger is, according to Felix Rohatyn's statement on this particular occasion, was you got people like LaRouche, a potential Franklin Roosevelt. We cannot tolerate having a Franklin Roosevelt or something like it in power. Now, and therefore we've got to get rid of LaRouche, we've got to stop this, we've got to stop that. And they certainly did. He pushed, above others, to prevent anything being done to save the auto industry in 2005 and 2006. He did it. He did a lot of other things. And Democrats capitulated to him, as well as some Republicans. So, but you've in this situation in which we've got to get this thing under control, and people here just don't understand this, or don't wish to understand it. That's where our problem is.
Well, you just came back from Russia, where it's clear from the various interviews, the interviews on Russian television and on leading websites. And by the way, our listeners can get access to them by going to LaRouchePack.com, and you'll see a whole section on the recent visit of Lynn and Helga LaRouche to Russia to honor the 80th birthday of Stanislav Menshikov. But clearly in Russia there is a discussion of FDR, which is related to your work. And it's also clear that Russia and China are resisting globalization. What's your sense now that you've been back and had a chance to reflect on it?
Well, to go back where we were talking about the other question, globalization is the attempt to set up a single world empire, which will eliminate the United States as a factor in world politics. That doesn't mean destroy the United States. It means eliminate it. It means eliminating the power of nation states around the world. And putting them under world government, in effect. It's an empire. Globalization is an empire, in which you have a lot of people speaking different languages who don't speak each other's languages. They're under a common government. It's a world government, which they don't run, obviously. And what you're seeing now in Western Europe and Central Europe, and seeing in the United States, you're seeing governments don't function. These governments have broken down. The U.S. government has broken down. The governments of Western and Central Europe have more or less broken down, and there's no sign they're going to come back in the present form. So therefore, what you're seeing is the effect of hedge funds and other devices trying to create an empire, like the old Venetian Empire, the medieval one, in which governments have no power, or they don't exist. We're on that point. Now, therefore, to break this power, remember the major financial power of the world is concentrated in things like hedge funds, an international system of globalization, power of Babel all over again. Now, you have three nations which are very large, apart from the United States, which are powerful in their own way. They're different. That is, they don't have any common features, really. They are different nations, but they have one thing in common. They're major nations, and they are people who believe in the nation state, who believe in sovereignty, the United States, Russia, China, and India, and they're also large and relatively powerful. Therefore, a bloc of these four nations, provided they come to an agreement on this point, can bring other nations in and form a world bloc of a majority of the human race, represented by their nations, who say, we're going to fix this. And we're going back to a system, a global system of sovereign nation states who are going to cooperate in the way that Franklin Roosevelt intended, had he lived, to organize the post-war world. That's the one shot we have. Now, what I was in Russia, this is recognized in a peculiar way. The Putin administration, the President Putin of Russia, has been saying going into the celebration of the end of World War II and other occasions, has been emphasizing the importance of Franklin Roosevelt's administration as the partner of preference for Russia and other countries. So you have an open door for the United States from the Russian government for unusual degrees of cooperation on this plan to try to get the world back in shape. Well, all we need is to have people in the United States who are official, who represent something, to say to Putin, let's do it. And to say to China, let's do it. And to say to India, let's do it. And say, the four of us, we should invite some other countries, like Germany and Japan and so forth. They should join this process. We got a group of nations which represents the majority of the power of the world, saying we're going to control this crisis, this great financial economic crisis. We're going to stabilize the world together by going back to the kind of Bretton Woods system that Franklin Roosevelt intended, as a system which is based on cooperation among nations. We're going to stabilize the currencies. We're going to create masses of credit for development. We're going to look ahead two generations, that is 25 and 50 years. We're going to look at long-term investments and plans to rebuild the world economy physically and to fix these problems and stabilize the situation now. That we can do. That is exactly what we can do now. The thing is jamming up the works. Otherwise, we could do it. I know as of now, I know that if the relevant persons in the United States were to, with official backing, were to go to Moscow now and make this proposal and make the same thing to China and India and a few other countries, they would adopt it. We could then proceed to fix the problem. If we don't do that, there's no chance for this planet.
You're listening to Lyndon LaRouche on The LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's a rare occasion when we actually get Lyndon LaRouche on The LaRouche Show. So we're very happy for that. Now, Lynn, before I bring on the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement from this side of the Atlantic, we do have a question from Germany, from Natalie or Natalia from the German limb, who has a question about the kinds of problems they get in organizing there. She said that they bring up the question of FDR and something like the TVA, and there are people who think that's socialist planning. So she wants to know, how do you address this effectively when you get this kind of confusion or disinformation, a lot of which comes from Rowetten and his types?
Yeah, you just say, well, what's the alternative? What's going to happen to Germany if we don't do this kind of thing? Don't talk about socialism. Talk about the policy. If we, look, you have the €1 job situation. You have actually all of Europe, Western Europe and Central Europe, is now ungovernable. The German coalition government's about to split up. I can't see from where I stand how they've got a combination you can put together to have a stable government. You have a situation which in German history reminds you, a threatened condition, reminds you of the fall of the Mueller government in the 1920s. And after the fall of the Mueller government, which was a coalition government, they were never able, until Hitler came to power, to get a unified government. They had emergency governments, which were generally managing the bankruptcy of the world at that time, and Germany in particular. And this condition of ungovernability, because there was no coalition of forces which could actually govern in a unified way, created the condition under which Hitler was possible. We now have, in Eastern Europe, in Germany, in France and so forth, we have conditions like that. France is still seems to be solid, but the conditions there are not stable. And this new government may not work out too well. So you have a condition like the condition under which Hitler came to power in Germany is now rampant throughout Western and Central Europe, and is also in the United States, because this Cheney-Bush arrangement is a case of a failed nation. The U.S. Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate cannot do anything about the major issues facing this nation. When they get up to the gate of doing something important, they fall apart. They break down. They can't do it. So you have a failed state in the United States. You have a failed state in Europe. These are the conditions under which horrible things happen, including dictatorships like Hitler's. We have to get this thing back together again. And the only way you're going to do it is with Franklin Roosevelt-type methods. And the one thing you've got to look at is what Franklin Roosevelt did to save the world, including saving it from a permanent Hitler dictatorship. And these kinds of measures, these developmental programs, based on public infrastructure and special financing arrangements for rebuilding industries and protectionist programs, which enable Germany to still have some industries, which they're losing now. Do you realize we lost our industry in the United States? We lost the automobile industry? Oh, yeah, we have a Japanese auto industry here, which works our people at cheaper prices than they did when the U.S. companies were operating. But we have lost our auto industry. We're losing essential parts of the things on which our life depends. And if the government does not step in to provide the initiative to reverse that policy, you're going to have hell on earth throughout this planet, including Germany and the United States.
If you have an email question you want to send in, we can take it at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we'll try to get to your emails as they come in. Let me bring in the LaRouche Youth Movement panel now. We'll start with Hector Rivas, who is here with me in Houston. Hector, do you have something for Lynn?
Yeah, actually I do. LaRouche, this is basically something that I thought about previously, although currently now I can kind of see why you say this, but the first time you brought in the idea of the United States, Russia, India and China cooperation as a necessary cooperation for the planet. Previously, looking at reports as what happened in places like Argentina, you know, some nationalizing that occurred in Central America and so forth, it became a little bit confusing, at least in my part, in terms of why you specifically chose China, India and Russia as a necessary partnership. But I think now it's a much clearer picture, but I would still like for you to kind of expound on the reasons why you would choose that. I mean, exactly what is the difference aside from is it really a matter of the type of resources they have or the type of national sovereignty that they have in themselves as a nation? And also, is the very reason why you're saying that Russia, India, China is a necessary partnership, is that the same reason that you see so much potential and good that can come about from these four nations? Is that the same reason why the Synarchist International behind Cheney is strategically also trying to go after these particular nations too?
Absolutely, it is. Remember, China's 1.4 billion people. At least they admit that much. There may be 1.5 for all I know. India has over 1 billion people. Russia is a major nation which is sitting on top of the potential for developing the major part of the raw material reserves of Eurasia. And it has the capability in terms of historically determined technological capability to do that job. The United States is obvious. The United States, we have the dollar. We are bankrupt, but the dollar is what the debts of the world are denominated in largely. That is the debt, the obligations, the debt of the United States in terms of the dollar to other nations which use the dollar is a major factor, which is the bust or break or build factor in world history right now. So therefore, if you have these nations and you bring in around them other nations, such as maybe Germany or other countries, Japan, so forth, you now have the majority of the human race and the majority of nation-state power of the human race is assembled in a relatively small package. Therefore, once you say, we're going to change the world, what are they going to do? We represent collectively the majority of power in the world. And if we say something is going to be fixed, and someone says they don't like it, we'll say, well, you don't have to like it. We're going to do it ourselves, for ourselves. And at that point, everybody who's not an idiot on this planet will come around rather quickly to join with us and cooperate with us. So therefore, pulling this specific group of nations together around this type of perspective is the one thing that will save the world. No other group of nations pulled together could do it. But if we start it, we'll be joined. And all the objectors in London and so forth will find themselves in great difficulty of not being lynched by their own people if they refuse to join with us.
Lynn, I noticed you've recently started to mention the signs of hope that Japan could join such a coalition. And there's some discussion again of the yen carry trade. What's going on in Japan?
Well, the Japanese realize that this whole thing is crazy and it's their currency that's going to down. Now, Japan has not yet been hit hard in terms of its basic technological capability. It's been hit, but not that hard. You have a faction in Japan which still believes in industry. And they also believe in a long-term perspective, especially with respect to Eurasia in particular. They want cooperation with China. Anyone in Japan who does not want cooperation with China is nuts. Anyone in Japan who doesn't want cooperation with Russia and Korea is nuts. If they don't want cooperation with other parts of the Pacific and Indian Ocean, they would be nuts. They do. So therefore, Japan, because the Japan carry trade, that is the low-interest overnight issue of yen, which is then picked up at wholesale and retailed in other parts of the world, is a key part of the world financial system. Therefore, Japan is crucial. Now, obviously, if the United States, China, Russia, India were to say, we will sponsor an initiative for other nations to join, Japan would be one of the first to join. So, and there are other nations of the same type. Southeast Asia, for example, you have a lot of people there. Indonesia needs it. Malaysia needs that kind of cooperation, and so forth. And these nations would generally come to agreement on the kind of arrangement we would be proposing.
Okay, so let's go to Shauna Wadarte. Shauna's in Chicago. You have a question for Lynn.
Sure. Lynn, I realize in order to not become the drop-off of the current crisis, we would have to impeach Dick Cheney. And it was clear from the state convention in San Diego that you don't rely on the leadership of the Democratic Party to impeach him, but it's forced upon the leadership from the population. But the population has to realize that they have that power. So how do you communicate to a population, especially in the area of the Midwest that's been depressed by the economic situation? How do you communicate to them that type of power, that type of optimism?
We did it in California. We did it in Boston. We did it in Massachusetts. We could do it everywhere. If you get some states in the United States, you do it in, it will spread to other states. We have a lot of projects like this land bridge, Alaska land bridge, that has much pull in the Northwest. It has pulled naturally in Alaska and in the state of Washington and potentially in California and elsewhere. So you have centers of this. You have a need in Texas for this sort of thing. And we have support from people. Now, you're not looking for majority support in the sense of you have to line up 51% of the population in every state. You know you don't have to do that. If you have 5% of the population lined up with you for projects like this, you've got as good as 60% of the vote if you really work it right. And that's what happened. That's what happened in California. A small group of us acting in the proper way, with some help from Louisiana, of all places, moved the entire Democratic Party, which was not particularly willing to do this, into the impeach Cheney operation and some other things. We've had a similar situation in Boston. You have that all over the country. This is a question where the subjective factor in history is decisive. Leadership is decisive. And the earning of credibility, not necessarily getting it handed to you, but earning credibility and being appropriate and to the point, you can win, especially when everybody smells that the Democratic Party leadership is screwed up, the Republican leadership is a shambles. They're trying to pretend they don't know who George Bush is, let alone Cheney. Huh? So you have a vacuum in reality, a lack of leadership. There is no effective leadership coming out of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party as parties right now. You have people who are Democrats and Republicans who are serious about politics and are involved in it, but they have no sense of leadership. You come in with a program that makes sense, which appeals to the interests of the base of the population, or a large part of it, and they're going to listen if you do your organizing properly. The problem we have is that some of our people really don't have a sense of how you do that, whereas some of our people do. And when we have a sense of that, and these states, like in, as in California and Massachusetts recently, for example, where we proceed in that way, you don't need a big, you know, hoopla for you going in. You have to realize that these guys have a problem. They don't know what to do about it. The party leadership doesn't know what to do about it. Some of the party leadership doesn't even want to try to do anything about it. You walk in with people who are anxious about the conditions of life in this country, and you walk in with a couple of proposals which make sense and should be voted up, and you've got a fair shot of getting it done. And that's the way we're going to do it. Not by having big majorities. You're going to come in with a small group of people who show they have leadership capability. They're going to demonstrate it. Well, the other guys look at themselves and say, you've got to let these guys come in. You've got to let them provide leadership because we're not able to do it without them. And that's the way it does. That's the way it's done.
Okay, so we're on with Lyndon LaRouche. I want to give you a phone number to call if you want to get the EIR. It's going to, the next issue will have the Democrats' Wake Up piece from Lynn. Also, full coverage of the Russia situation, the trip by Lynn and Helga to Russia. So that number is 800-278-3135. It's a free call for you, 800-278-3135. And when you call in to ask for the free literature, you can also make a contribution. These kinds of fights can't be won for free. Now, Lynn, let me bring on Leona, who's hanging out in the basement of your house in out near Leesburg. So, Leona, you have a question for Lynn?
Yeah, hi, Lynn. I actually have a in light of the collaboration you're calling for right now with the Big Four, Russia, China, India, and the United States, what are you seeing is the youth role in both outreach as well as the scientific collaboration internationally, especially in context of what we're producing out with the project that you've initiated with the Kepler, Gauss, and Riemann curve?
Well, what happens is, as you know from experience, that when you get into a project like this, which is generally not done in universities these days anymore, and you get developed competence, and when you have groups of people who go through these kinds of projects, which are the ABCs, essentially, of modern science, and touch upon the most crucial points of development of modern science, you develop competence. You develop not only competence, but by working through a problem like this Ceres project, which you're working on now, you come out of there with actually scientific capabilities, maybe not perfected scientific capabilities, but perfected in some respects. And as you saw with we did with the Kepler-2 project, you saw that we came out of that with something which was more advanced in the sense of scientifically, in some respects, than is known among professional science in the field of astronomy today. So you're coming out with competence. When you come out with confidence into a crisis period, in which we're going to have to make a fundamental reversal of the past quarter century, 30-year period in scientific technology outlook in the United States. We're going back, if the United States is going to survive, and if the world is going to survive, We're going back from a post-industrial society to back to a science driver of industrial society, agro-industrial society. Now, out there, there are a lot of people who know how to play with computers. But that's just numbers. That's not science. Science is actually dealing with the crucial elements of how you discover a universal physical principle. That's where competence lies. That combined with engineering. So therefore, the fact that we have people who are developing, who are oriented to scientific competence and technological competence, in a population where the entire present past two generations in the United States have been turned away from it in their entire childhood adult experience, means that you are capable of providing leadership. And what this world requires now, as you see from the failure from the top of the Democratic and Republican body, for example, there is no competence in leadership on this kind of thing in terms of the party organization as it's structured now. Yes, we do move in. When we move in with competence, we will find other people we can pull together who also represent competence. For example, on the Alaska project, on the Landbridge project of the Straits, we're pulling together real scientific capability on this project. It's on both sides. On the Russian side, and on the U.S. side, and also the Canadian side. We're pulling together competence. But we are the catalyst who are pulling this competence together. And that's what this means. To do what you're doing down there, down in the basement, and was done before with the Kepler projects, would be done with the Riemann projects. These things represent the essence of scientific competence. At the high point of all modern science, from ancient Greece to the time present time, the essence of the matter. This is the core of competence. And there are people around in their 60s and 70s and so forth who do represent competence from a time that competence was still valued. We tend to revive these people into action. We become the catalyst which helps to pull them together around a task-oriented mission. And we can get the job done. And that's what's key.
To follow that up, we have an email question from Scott from the LIM who asks about the lack of training for young people in such techniques or such skills as welding and machine tool technology. And he was asking, how would you go about reestablishing the kind of training programs that are needed for the skilled labor for these kinds of projects?
Don't try to start from a job skill level. The way to do the job, you want competence? Don't send a guy to go out to some place to learn how to weld. He's going to have to do that, perhaps. But the way you do it the other way. You start from the top. You take a project of building something and making it work. Now, when you start to do something and taking ideas and trying to put them together, as some people did with the tetrahedral, project on the Kepler work. When you do that and start to build a project, you require yourself to bring in some guy who can show you how to do it on this or that technique, and you become familiar with it, and you begin to work with them or people like them. So now, because you're a part of a project in which these particular skills are integral, you've built a task force, which people who have some of these skills will share it with other people, and people who want to come in and learn it will come in the context of that task force, and they will also pick up these skills. And that's the way you do it. You take a project, a mission-oriented project. Look, we did that in World War II. It was done by the Hopkins Operation under Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. And they were faced with a mission. The Hopkins group, which Roosevelt brought in, included some famous generals, guys who were leaders in World War II. It also involved Eisenhower and MacArthur in that 1930s and their own role in this thing on the Industrial Development Project. So what Roosevelt did, knowing the day that he was president, he was inaugurated as president, Hitler had become a dictator. Roosevelt knew we were headed toward World War II then. So Roosevelt had two problems. The United States would have to prepare for the fact that war was being threatened down the line, probably within his time in office. And at the same time, the U.S. economy had fallen by over 30% between the time that Hoover was inaugurated and the time that Roosevelt was inaugurated in that period. You had to rebuild the shattered U.S. economy, rebuild shattered people who'd lost skills, who'd lost jobs, who'd lost perspective. And you had to, at the same time, build up the greatest military force as an economic force the world had ever seen to deal with the threat of war which is coming down the pike. We took people from the streets. We took people into the CCCs who had no skills. We organized them around projects in which they picked up these skills. And we showed that we could produce like no one had ever dreamed you could produce before. And so take it from the, don't try to work your way from the bottom up of learning a skill and learning a skill and learning a skill. Take it from the top down. Take the mission. Build a bridge. Build a high-speed rail system. Build things that are needed. You don't have the skills? Well, develop them as part of the project. And that's how you do it.
I think we need to get people to build that Bering Strait tunnel. And I like the proposal that came out of the meeting in Moscow that we name the Alaska point on it, the LaRouche station. So, Lynn, we have another question from the Lim in Germany on Iran, going back to the strategic crisis. Sandra wants to know if there's any chance that Russia would respond militarily to protect Iran, given the escalation by Cheney to provoke a war there.
Now, the Russia doesn't want to do that. It doesn't want to get involved in that. There are many reasons why. It's not the right way to go. What has to be done, the point is we don't want to fight a war because fighting a war means fighting a thermonuclear war. That's what we're talking about. You want a thermonuclear war? You're going to have to use power in a slightly different way. And the way to fight that war is, first of all, get Cheney out of office in the United States. Do it. Don't let the Democrats say we're not going to impeach Cheney. Impeach him. And you don't really have to impeach him. You have to make it very clear to everyone around that this guy is going to be impeached unless he quits. And since he's committed some things that might be considered crimes, he doesn't want to be impeached because after the impeachment, then somebody may say, well, what about the crimes he committed? Impeachment doesn't cover the crimes. He commits crimes in office. He's responsible for being criminal. He's not protected for that. He deceived the government. He deceived the process. So what you want to do is you want to break his power. Whatever it takes, break that power. Make him quit. Huh? And do it fast. Now, then, what you do is you get a cooperative project among a group of nations, as the kind I've indicated, the four nations plus, and you say, hey, you're not going to do it. And he's going to say, who's going to stop me? And we say, we will.
Okay.
That's the way you deal with it. If you cannot find the way to use political power and economic power instead of military war-fighting power to deal with a problem like this, you're not thinking straight. We are now in the 21st century. We have the technological capability of virtually wiping out the human race with a couple of wars. With the kind of weapon systems that now exist, you have the United States is now putting up a space-based system to attack any part of the planet from space on Cheney's whim, perhaps. You're in that kind of world. Do you want to fight wars? Or do you want to be smart and learn how to use power through diplomacy and related means, which obviate the need to go to war to deal with problems? And therefore, before you get to that question, the answer to that question, say, okay, do you want to go to war? No. Does Russia want to go to war over Iran? no. Definitely not. There is no inclination to do so. However, will Russia be inclined to say, let's hope that somebody from the United States walks into us and says, let's have a four-power agreement and bring some other nations in too? Then you're talking. And we've got to be smart instead of stupid for a change.
Well, that would be a good switch in the United States. Let's go back to Shauna. Do you have another question, Shauna, for Lynn?
No, not really. Not this time.
All right. Leona?
Yeah, actually, in the very beginning of your last paper, not the last paper, but the Skies Above paper, you mentioned the ungovernability. You started out with this concept of ungovernability. Then you said something. You said that a chain reaction can occur from things like, for example, what's going on with Arnold Schwarzenegger in California. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, you have Schwarzenegger's breaking apart. You notice that? He started out with one image, and he's shifting his image. He's now gone from Ferdinand the Bull. He's pushing up pansies. He's all over the place. You say, what's his party? What's his party politics? And what you're seeing with Schwarzenegger, who's making an ass of himself, which is a new role he didn't try before. He got pregnant, one role, but he hasn't gotten pregnant recently. And you find that the situation is such that politicians, when they're trying to make themselves impressive to get votes or to get backing, they turn themselves into silly fools because they don't have any coherence. They're just puppets on a string. You have to have an understanding that the United States now, the political class in the United States, the elected political class, represents a nation, the United States, in a state of political ungovernability. There's nothing so far in recent years, especially since the last presidential election, there's nothing has happened which shows that the United States political system is capable of governing itself on any important issue. And what you're seeing with Schwarzenegger, for example, you're seeing a man who went in with a big bag of wind and bluster. And he's now back to whimpering as a campaign strategy. And the problem is the United States essentially is internally, politically, the U.S. system is now essentially ungovernable. The houses of Congress are ungovernable. The White House apparatus is disintegrating. A very dangerous situation. And that's what our problem is. And that's what I'm trying to address.
I think also with Schwarzenegger, the more we go out after George Shultz, the more Schwarzenegger starts whimpering. So I think that's a good way to approach it. Lynn, we have a question from Paris from a French LIM member, Jenny, who said, in the organizing, the discussions get stuck when people ask us, what should I do? What can we do? And she said, they're usually asking for something practical and concrete. And she said that she's often unsatisfied with the answers we provide. So she'd like to hear your thoughts on, particularly in France, when someone says, what can we do, what should we tell them?
Well, first of all, you have to understand the situation. That's the first thing to say. That politics from the border of Russia and Belarus westward, all of Western continental Europe and Britain and so forth, is a failed state. France is also a failed state. Germany's a failed state. Italy is used to being a failed state, and they don't mind it so much. So therefore, if you're talking about doing something big, a single thing big, to improve the situation, you're wasting your time. Something can be done, but what? What you have to do is realize that you're dealing with a failed state, and you have to organize. We have to organize around conceptions which are not little itty-bitty things, little issues, little so-called practical issues. It's not going to do a thing. You see what we do in the United States, in the interventions at the convention in California and in Massachusetts, state Democratic convention. We were able to demonstrate how you can take a concrete issue, which is a typical issue of a special type, go with that, and you find you can move something in the political process. Now, that's what you have to do, but not little itty-bitty things, not issues. But you have to pick on programmatic approaches which go directly to the question of providing leadership, or mobilizing leadership in a situation where the government itself or the political process does not have any real leadership in it. So therefore, going for the crucial turn is what's important. And your thinking has to start from the top down, not from the bottom up. The typical thing in politics is the little politician always tries to get at the little, start with the local community issues and work your way up. And they accomplish nothing in the long run. You start from the top, thinking from the top. Now you think like a military strategist. You're thinking from the top. You want to win the war. You try to think about what is the thing that you can do that will lead, that's feasible, that will contribute to a process which will enable you to win the war. So you don't take little issues by themselves because they have some kind of appeal and try to build on that one after the other and hope that it will lead you to power. You start from the intention to exert political power on the nation as a whole or the world as a whole. Now you define what you're going to do in terms of organizing to win everything from wherever you are. And when you operate that way, you don't get into the usual demoralization the so-called local politics gets you into in most countries.
When you talk about working from the bottom up, I get an obscene image of Al Gore, but I don't think we want to discuss that right now.
No, we don't. Al Gore's bottom is not something I want to discuss.
So Hector, I know, had another question on this matter, on leadership. Hector, go ahead.
Well, I think it's, at least for myself, and I know I probably speak for others, is that there's a very clear understanding that this role of leadership, the requirements that you're putting out that are necessary to transform the planet into something much beneficial for civilization. Ultimately, aside from the work that you're doing, which is, you know, very unique and very important, is that the leadership is going to have to come effectively in our part, ourselves. And so, you know, I just think from the standpoint that, you know, I don't necessarily know if you're going to be around, you know, in about 20 years or so. But definitely...
Let's frighten them. Let's frighten them and tell them I am.
Okay. Great. Well, that'll be good for us. But but for the role of the, of the youth here, who is going to actually have to take up the fight that you instigated, and it's very necessary, morally necessary, that we continue it. You know, there's obviously you laid out the curriculum of how to actually adopt your method of thinking, because it's, you know, very clear that it's the mental quality that you possess that is really the basis for how we're going to save the planet. And so what I would ask is, I mean, you've had a lot of people, us, even youth and a relative small amount of boomers who actually decided to take an allegiance with you based on this. And there will be more in the future as we continue to recruit by necessity. And so what I ask on behalf of the future and of youth now is, in a moment like what we have today, I mean, looking at you representing the opposite, the alternative, and looking how you have a situation that's clearly ungovernable, clearly catastrophic in Iran and so on and so forth, what Cheney intends to do in general, how do we reach to our comrades who have actually, not because of negligence, but because of fear, become a little bit hesitant on taking up the challenge? And I ask this on behalf of also the leadership, because there's a stronghold that will stick with you to accomplish this. But as a leadership, how do we ensure that the fight continues on our own part?
It's a question of method. You know what I do with people in the basement in these projects, which I pull the projects away from the larger centers, that is, from offices and so forth, and pull them up into the basement of the up there in the farm. Why? Well, there are two aspects to it. First of all, because I wanted to get the work away from over-supervision from prying eyes, who all were going to come in and put their finger into making advising that this be done, or this be done, or this be done. I wanted a task-oriented group which was going to be somewhat autonomous. And the one thing that I specify, which is not usually done these days, is I was not going to sit on top of them and blow their nose for them. And these groups have done very well. And I've seen this before, but it's not done so much in universities anymore. What you have to do is you have to have people develop their own creativity, not learn how to follow a recipe, but to develop the recipe themselves, and not as a recipe, but as a discovery in the process of a mission orientation. We've had success. We've had Kepler 1 successful. Kepler 2 was more successful because it was built on the foundations of Kepler 1. Then we went. We also had, of course, the work which was done earlier on the work on, for example, doubling the cube and things of that stuff, which in the Pythagoreans and Plato, and also some focus on the problem of mathematics in terms of the work of Gauss as against his opponents in the 18th century. But so we build on this. Now, my emphasis is you get people to develop by getting them a group of peers to work together to develop to solve the problem. And my role in these, what goes on in the basement, is very limited. It may be crucial because I say something, but I say as little as possible because I want them to solve the problem. I don't want to give them the answers. Now, that's the key to leadership. What the worst kind of leadership is one which is bossy, it's all over the place. And leadership, for example, in warfare, from the top of the command in warfare, as you study these things, it's the same thing. Effective leadership is not blowing everybody's nose for them, not telling them how to think. It's putting them in a situation with an orientation which people have to work together to develop the internal intellectual skills and knowledge which qualifies them to be leaders. And in most political organizations, for example, and also business organizations, the way that top people lead their people as subordinates destroys the capability for leadership. Leadership is something which comes from inside the development of the individual. And it's best developed by interactive groups, where interactive groups are acting together to develop their own capabilities so they don't study a subject to master it. When they finish the job, they own the knowledge because they made it themselves. And that's the secret of leadership. And that's my policy, and I wish that more people would understand that. That's the way to do it. It's the best kind of way of developing military leadership, business leadership, intellectual leadership. And that's what I believe in, is not to sit and tell people what to do. Yes, I'll tell them what I think. I'll tell them what I think they should do. But when it comes to developing them, I do not assume that they're going to develop them by telling them how to blow their own nose, but by giving them the opportunity, by organizing it, so they work together in developing knowledge, especially knowledge which has a creative implication to it. And when they develop the knowledge themselves, rather than learning what they're told to believe, then they own that knowledge. It's theirs. It's inside them. And then they have the capabilities of leadership. And the problem I have with our own organization is there's a tendency to go to so-called conventional ways of leadership, and they don't work. It's when people work through a project themselves as a group, as these groups in the basement are doing. When they come out of that project having succeeded in the mission, and they've learned a lot of things, they've developed themselves in the process, they come out of there and they own what they know. In other kinds of education, as in classroom cases, they come out of it learning to repeat after me. They really don't know what they're talking about. But once you know what you're talking about, and you develop a sense of what it is inside yourself to operate with pungency and force, because you know what you're talking about, to have that kind of sense of yourself, inside yourself, is the nature of true leadership. And that's what we need to develop.
Lynn, this hour has gone by so quickly. I have one final question for you from a friend of yours in the California Democratic Party who said he knows that you're not going to be a candidate for the presidency, at least that you said that in 2008, but he said he also knows you're not just going to be an interested spectator. So he asked, what role do you expect to play in the 2008 election, and how can he help you?
I'm going to give the people who should be leading, and I hope they will manifest themselves, the relevant uplifting kick at all times. And what I need is what I can give. What I can give is exactly what I just described in answer to the question from Texas, is to get people who are potential leaders and get them together and give me a chance to do the same thing with them that we're doing with the youth down in the basement. You take the assignment of working out the programmatic material which is needed for dealing with the crises we have in the United States today, and let them work it out for themselves, but in a task-oriented group. We need to pull together the potential leaders, political leaders, at all ages around the United States. I mean, some people who are, you know, almost as old as I am. Some may be even a mite older. And those people with that kind of potential, when brought together, must work together in the way I just indicated now, in just answering this other question, to develop what they own in themselves. They own the kind of knowledge of what their leadership role must be. And that's the way we've got to run it. We've got to run it in depth. And if you start to spread this kind of thing around in terms of organizing people, say, don't go through channels alone. Also go aside, outside of channels, and start to develop leadership, group leadership, of people who know what they're talking about because they own what they know.
Okay, well, Lynn, thank you very much. There's a whole board full of questions we didn't get to, so we're going to be forwarding them to you. If your questions were not taken up on the air, we'll be forwarding them to Lyndon LaRouche. Lynn, thank you for joining us today, and to the listeners, thank you for joining us on The LaRouche Show, and we'll be back again next Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And in the meantime, go out and do something to impeach Cheney.
Yes, good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.